Before we get rolling, just a quick warning that this podcast does feature real uncensored conversations with real uncensored people, so some of the language may not be appreciated by all.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Hello, world. Welcome back to Living to Write, where in each episode we talk with a notable writer about their methods, challenges, and advice for other writers. I'm Brian Landwehr, and I'm a writer. If you are too, or if you'd like to be, you're in the right place. With me each episode is my cohort, Bailey Patterson, who is also a writer when he isn't busy producing this fine podcast. Say hello to the nice listeners, Bailey.
Hello, listeners. And we're back. And
we're back.
I think we promised to stay back or somewhat consistent at least, right?
I think we've broken some promises along the way, but I hope we can regain some trust here today.
It's just like Hollywood, right? Hearts being broken left, right, and center.
That's right. We're just trying to give our listeners the true Hollywood experience. Big promises.
Exactly.
And slow to deliver.
Right. So I'm on a deadline right now in the middle of a rewrite. And last night I found myself at 2 a.m. opening up Final Draft. Yes, I still use Final Draft, Brian.
That's
love John
cute.
August. And I know. And I knew you were going to say something about that. But we can save that debate for another episode.
Yeah.
But I found myself starting to write a brand new project and script. And, you know, before I know it, like 5 pages had emerged from this new project. And I think it's something our listeners and maybe you can relate to, where
you're working
on something and, oh no, I have this idea for this other project. Oh, let me jump into that. And I think it's normal for any writer to sort of have this, but.
Right. I think it's toxic and healthy all at the same time. I mean, if you never get anything done, then it's toxic. And if it gives you a little break and you have some inspiration for the next project you're going to hit and you're able to put that down and get back to what you're trying to finish, then I guess it's healthy. So yeah, which is it going to be for you, toxic or healthy?
Is there something in between I can pick?
Sure. Make up a term.
Right. Yeah. Maybe I'll choose the healthy side. Maybe,
okay.
Maybe I should pay.
Oh, good.
I'll be disciplined and finish this, but I was hoping maybe that our guest today might have some insight on this and maybe she can guide us into her process. And
well, you did find us a good guest, and I'm going to assume she has lots of great insight on all sorts of things. Our guest today is Sophia Libitsky-Weitz, and she is both a playwright and a film writer. She has an original Peacock series in development with Sarah Blush. She works on The Bear on FX. She worked on The Dropout on Hulu, plus Gaslit on Stars, and she has other projects on the way. She's worked on multiple features with Michael Showalter, including The Eyes of Tammy Faye. And as a playwright, her work has been developed in Los Angeles and New York and Chicago. And she's got a play called This Party Sucks, which is going to be commercially produced in the coming year. And if all that isn't enough, she's a McDowell Fellow, she was a panelist for the 2023 Austin Film Festival, and she serves on the advisory board at Northwestern University, where she got her MFA in writing for the screen and stage. Given all that, and it's a lot, given all that, I'm thrilled as can be that she was able to make time for us today. Let's talk with her. Are you ready to do this, Bailey?
Yes, Chef.
Well said. Dear listeners, I give you now Sophia Libitsky-Weitz.
Lights, camera, action.
Hey.
Well, hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to start with my cop-out question, which some people think is an incredible softball and some people find agonizing, which is, why are you a writer?
I feel like I'm a writer because I'm obsessed with words and people and relationships. And I think, like, you know, any artist has their medium. And for me, like, I appreciate all art, but like the way that words can be put together to create emotion and reveal relationships and reveal secrets and sort of subtext and meaning and theme has always been really, really exciting to me. Apparently, according to my parents, I was writing before I was reading, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't really understand how
I
that
would like
works.
to
They like
understand
to
that as
say
well. Yeah.
that. But I was apparently cryptically writing little stories at a very young age, and then became a huge reader. And they would sort of put me in my crib and stack up a bunch of books and just like leave me there. And so reading and engaging with words is such a big part of what I do. And then specifically going into playwriting and then screenwriting and TV writing, it's sort of like that love of words and language combined with my love of like people and collaboration and making it alive in that way. So as much as I love sort of engaging with all of the types of art and all written form, like performance and that type of writing is what I love to devote my life to for that reason.
So did it start with playwriting for you? Yes. And how did you get to there?
Yeah, so I as a kid, like I said, was sort of always writing. And so growing up, I was writing a lot of stories. I wrote some like really dark mystery novels in elementary school, and poems and short stories, and was just writing like crazy. And then at the same time was getting really involved in theater. So I was acting and directing, designing. I went to an arts high school in Orange County, where I was getting to sort of do all of that.
Ah.
But then I was like really afraid of playwriting for some reason. I was like, this seems like such a hard form. And I was sort of like scared to combine these loves that I had of like writing and then like performance in theater. And then I was finally like, I need to try this because it's this combination of all of my passions in a lot of ways. And then it really wasn't until college. I went to undergrad at Loyola Marymount, and Beth Henley was teaching there at the time. She's an amazing playwright. And I was like, well, I have to take her class. I have to try it. And I wouldn't say that playwriting like came easily to me at first. It's really, really hard. And I am so rigorous about dialogue and like dialogue sounding good and real. And it was really a practice of getting into that. And then sort of worked and worked and worked at it. Decided to go to grad school for playwriting, and chose a dual degree program at Northwestern, which would allow me to learn about film and TV as well, so that I could also eventually take that route, which has amazingly been my path. But it really was sort of this love of theater, and theater is still my first love. It's a complicated love, but it's definitely my first love. But then it's been so incredible to transition into film and TV and get to experience those worlds too.
Do you still get to spend quite a bit of time in the world of theater, or is it just your primary love that's a little ignored at the moment?
It depends. It really depends, like year by year and project by project. I think COVID was really hard on theater, as it was on a lot of things, especially live performance. And that was the timing that I moved into film and TV, so I got very lucky to be able to make that transition at the time. But the sort of year by year, it depends on like what I sort of participate in. I will say that in moving to LA, like I'm in New York a lot, but coming back to LA, there's just less sort of theater opportunities that I'm involved in. There is theater out here, but I'm so immersed sort of in film and TV that it definitely doesn't take up as much as my time. Whereas when I lived in New York for 6 years, it was like that was my world. Those are my people. I was seeing stuff all the time. But I did. I wrote my first new play in 4.5 years, I think it was. Last year, I finally sort of finished a big revision of it. So I'm excited to sort of see what happens with that. And I have a couple of things that are sort of meant to happen in the next year or so, that will take me back into theater. So it's really fun to be able to have the balance because I really enjoy all three forms. And so getting to have them inform each other is really fun.
When you say that they're meant to happen in the next year, do you mean that in a cosmic sense, or do you just mean in a schedule sense?
In a schedule sense, yeah, but I don't let until something is like 100%, it's so hard to, everything is imaginary until it's not. But
Sure.
yeah, but there are plans in effect. It's just a matter of how they pan out. But yes, also cosmic. Yeah.
So
Appreciate the cosmic too.
you mentioned when you made the leap from theater to writing for screen. How did you make that leap? What was the connection? What was the opportunity for you?
Yeah, you know, when I break it down, it really, you know, I always tell people it's sort of the combination of two things for my path, which is one is a single play that I have, honestly. It's one play that I wrote in my late 20s or like mid to late 20s that was sort of based on a really personal experience that I sort of heightened in this fun way. And it's very raw, it's very emotional. And particularly like film and TV people really love it. And it's gotten me literally all of my jobs. It's been the thing, you know, I have a pilot as well that people love, but it's really this play that has like unlocked a lot of, these interviews for me and these, relationships, which is really cool. It's not always the case, but I think, you know, I always tell that to people because I think, you know, as a writer, especially if you're starting out, like you should write the thing that only you can write that comes from your like blood, sweat, and tears. And that play really was that for me and has been. And then also just like building relationships over the course of a decade and making these connections. And in a more specific way, I was doing a fellowship, a playwriting fellowship in Minneapolis for 1 year before COVID. It was 2018, 2019. And I had a professor from Northwestern, my graduate program, connect me with an amazing writer named Sarah Gubbins, who was working on a project at the time and was looking for like an assistant, but she really wanted for a mini room, but she really wanted like someone who could be a mind in the room, like who would engage and you know, do research and take notes, but also be there. And it was really just a couple women and we're just in an Airbnb in Brooklyn. And that was like my first TV experience. And I had never been in a room before. And it was like a very untraditional room in a lot of ways. But I learned so, so, so much from them. And that was my first sort of foray. And then she recommended me to Michael Showalter, who was working on a movie. And I sort of helped him with some research. He eventually brought me in to work on the script. Sort of just like trying to work really hard and do a really good job. And also, you know, even in those assistant positions or sort of research positions, making my thoughts clear as a writer and, you know, being a resource and, you know, talking about the work, because I think that's what people are looking for at any level. And then ultimately I got staffed on my first show, which was a show called Gaslit on Stars, after, you know, having reps and them submitting me for traditional rooms for about a year. And then COVID happened and I got staffed in this room in September 2020. And so I was still living in New York and it was all on Zoom. And that was through, you know, my reps, but also a producer that I had met who also liked the same play. And then, you know, the subject matter was exciting to me. It was really about this marriage and this like misunderstood, complicated woman, and sort of checked all these boxes for me. That was my first experience. It was a really amazing, rigorous room. And then right from there, got into the mini room for The Bear, which was a similar thing of like connection, knowing people, this same play, you know, having these sort of connective tissue. And then from there have been lucky to sort of been working steadily since then and moved back to LA in the middle of that as well. And then as well as having my own projects and stuff too. So it's been cool. I've worked on almost entirely new shows and getting to sort of see them get built from the ground up, which is really cool, which I'm still doing. And I think, you know, I've had a really amazing track record of just projects that have come out really well and been well received. And that's exciting because it's always, you know, it's amazing to be employed no matter what, but it's special to work on things that people respond to.
Oh yeah. When we look you up online, the list of projects that you've been involved in is not the longest list, but it is a very special list. It's totally exceptional. And I'm more than a little bit of a fanboy for The Bear, one of the finest shows I have ever watched. So I'm going to avoid going off on that for 90 minutes right now, but we are coming back to talking about The Bear specifically.
Great.
But in the meanwhile, since we're specifically talking about your career thus far and the pattern it took, I want to ask about the writing itself. What does your process look like? Mm. How do you get it done? Are you a same time every morning, 6 days a week sort of person, or what's your approach to it? How do you get the work done?
I love this question because I really love to talk about process, because I think, yes, like especially for, you know, writers starting out or writers at any level, at any experience level, like it's always fascinating to hear about other people's processes because everyone's so different. And I think when you're trying to form your own process, or I'll speak for myself, you know, I struggled a lot with like what I should be doing or how I should be conducting myself as a writer. And I think you have to learn, you know, through practice, and you also have to be, you know, true to yourself. And there's a balance between, you know, discipline and working really hard, but also recognizing, you know, when your creative time is. And so a big thing for me is I've never been an everyday writer. It doesn't work like that for me. I think it's amazing. I've had jealousy about that for other people. I certainly do work every day, but as far as like making creative work, I'm not the type of person that can sort of sit and let it hit me. I have to have a lot of balance in my life. So I like to say I'm like work hard, play hard, rest hard, and I need sort of all of those things. And so much of the creative process for me is living life and going on walks and seeing people that I love and honestly staring into space and like writing my dreams down and letting sort of clearing space to sort of let I like to sort of think of it in like a weird witchy way where I sort of have like two sides of myself and I have like the editor like detective brain and like that's the side that like keeps my life running and like keeps my creative projects like on schedule and edits my work and revises and organizes everything. And then there's this other side that's like and that's the side that I'm like conscious of. And then the other side, which is like the unconscious, the wild, witchy side, she comes and goes as she pleases. Like she is very much like I don't know where she is at any given time, and she'll arrive. And all I know how to do, and what I've had to learn to do, is create conditions in which to like invite her in, basically. And she'll get spooked very easily, and she'll get annoyed very easily. So, you know, I think my process, you know, sometimes balance is over the course of a year, right? It's not necessarily that balance is every day. I'm in a really intense job right now, in a writer's room right now, and on my first like producer level, and it's really, really rigorous, and it's hard to make space for the creative time, but then. You know, after this job, I'll have that space where, like, the strike was a really interesting time for that, where, you know, though it was stressful, it really allowed me to reconnect to that creativity. So, all that being said, I am sort of a writer who needs deadlines, whether they are self-imposed or not.
Sure.
I like to say I'm motivated by humiliation. So, if I know that something needs to be read by someone, or I often like, you know, I started a writer's group here in LA, which has been amazing last fall. And, you know, I'll sign up to share my work and I respect these people. So if I don't get the thing done and it isn't how I want it to be, I'm going to be mad at myself. So I've always sort of been, you know, and then of course, when you're working, the deadlines are imposed externally. So I am definitely a writer where, you know, there'll be months and months and months where I won't write a creative thing. And that can feel really stressful. And especially if you're comparing yourself to others. But then, you know, for instance, this last play that I was talking about, I finally wrote it at a residency called McDowell, on the East Coast, and I wrote 150 pages in 2 weeks. Like it was
Wow.
percolating for a long time, and I didn't write a word of it for a long time, or I'll journal, or I'll think about it, or I'll talk about it. But when I sit down to write, the writing time happens really, really fast for me. So that's sort of how I've made peace with it. And also, I'm a night writer, which, is another thing I've had to make peace with. I think you're often told like get up in the morning and do it, but like my creative brain certainly doesn't work till like noon, but like at the earliest. But even like my non-creative brain, it's hard for me even before 10. But like since I was a teenager, this sort of late night time is the time when I can be creative, and that's really hard sometimes to integrate into sort of an adult life. But I have to carve out and make space for that if I really want to make something. And similarly, I have a my feminist horror movie feature that I'm really excited about, that I'm about to go out with, and that like I thought about for truly a year and a half and like journaled and thought about it, but then had a deadline with my writer's group and my agent, sat down, wrote 110 pages in a weekend before that, because it's really just about sort of like giving myself that space after I've like really had the time to percolate. So that's sort of what I've learned about my process, but I do sometimes still find myself fighting it or jealous of other people's process, but I just know that for me, I'm going to need those periods of just like space gathering and inspiration gathering and living time and rest to be able to sort of get into those really, really deep creative projects. But then of course, when I'm in a room like right now, you know, the work is every day. And especially the room I'm in right now is really research-based and reading heavy and intense. And so, you know, the work is a very different, has a very different quality to it.
Is it a period piece? Is that what makes it so research intensive?
Partially, yeah. So it's a new show. It's going to be on Hulu, which is really exciting. Yeah. And so, you know, the job feels a bit like part detective, part researcher, part, you know, resource gathering, part interviewer, part you know, excavator, cultural excavator. So it
Interesting.
really is, it's going to be a really incredible show. And it's, but it's definitely, you know, every show is really different as far as The Bear is weirdly the only show I've worked on that isn't based on some true thing, or so it's like it's a very different process to just be sort of making things up than like really having like a lot of raw material to draw from. And like we're reading testimonies, we're, you know, interviewing, you know, et cetera.
For the series, The Dropout, how much of your writing made it to screen in that case? Is a lot of that yours?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is with TV, we always joke like, you know, you get a lot of credit for things you didn't do and then no credit for things you did do. Like crediting is a very strange beast in TV because it is so collaborative. And you know, in some ways you know, you have, and you're in a room, you have your hand in sort of, you know, almost every decision that's made, but ultimately things change so much by the time, you know, they get filmed. And sometimes you can't even remember like what you pitched or what you wrote. The Dropout was a really interesting situation because I was not in the room. I was helping Liz basically right before production because it had been halted because of COVID. So I was working one-on-one with her, helping her with rewrites, helping her with notes, writing parts of the drafts. So I do feel like a lot of my sort of input got into the show. It's obviously, you know, Liz's brainchild and the room that came before me. But I think what really excited me about that process was I got really sort of into I'm obsessed with relationship arcs and emotional arcs, and I got really obsessed with sort of those main relationships in there, particularly like Sunny and Elizabeth, and kind of nerded out and wrote Liz these sort of long emails about like if their, you know, relationship is here in episode two, like it should be here by six, and sort of getting really deep into that. And I think that's one thing I sort of always bring to a TV project is just like really rigorously looking at these relationship and emotional arcs, particularly sort of the romantic arcs and complicated relationships is sort of like my bread and butter. So I feel proud of how those turned out for sure, and how I helped with those.
So I have to jump in while we're on the topic. First of all, thank you so much for sharing your creative process because I feel seen,
Good.
especially with you being a night owl and writing then because it's sort of yes. But could you sort of just walk us through? So it's Monday morning, it's the start of a new week. What does like a typical day or week in the writer's room sort of look like? Are you breaking story? Or are you guys still on Zoom? Is it back in person? What sort of could you give our listeners sort of an insight into what the
Yeah.
writers like? And
And how small are writers' rooms? These are all writers' rooms still mini rooms?
So we got a lot of things in this last deal, which were great. And part of that is the mini room itself is about sort of more about mini room can mean a lot of things, but the main thing we were sort of fighting for was longer periods of rooms. And I had been in a lot of shorter rooms, like 8 or 10 weeks, or even 5 weeks. And, you know, part of the argument with the WGA was, you know, we are not able to make a career if we're cobbling together these sort of short week rooms. So now there is the minimum of 20 weeks for a room, which is great. And especially, you know, you need that time. It's like it is a really rigorous process depending on the show. As far as like the size, it really varies project to project. I've been in mostly smaller rooms for sure. This current one, we have six writers, including the showrunner. And then six support staff, which is a huge support staff, and that's been amazing. So including like writer's assistant, showrunner assistant, we have like an interpreter, a researcher, and a PA. And so it feels like a very supportive room in that way. As far as Zoom or back in person, most are back in person now. There's a few that choose to be on Zoom. It's sort of like showrunner's choice, or I was in a room that was before the strike, a different room, and we got interrupted by the strikes. So then when we came back, we were on Zoom because they didn't want to pay for more, rent for a space. So it really depends. But this is my second, fully in person room because of starting working during COVID. And it's just so much better. I mean, Zoom is so convenient, and I think it's nice to have like 1 or 2 days, maybe a week or a half day. But to be able to be in person is just so much better for creativity. And it's funny because I started out on Zoom, so my first few rooms were on Zoom, and I didn't have a comparison I could imagine. And it really is so much better, and you bond also with your coworkers in such a different way. You're able
Sure.
to sort of, which leads to more creativity and more sort of flow in that way. And as far as the structure of the rooms, it always differs a bit, but I would say in general, writers' rooms go from sort of macro to micro. So you start out, for however long talking about the show itself, the themes, the characters, maybe the emotional arcs. My favorite part, sort of these big questions and ideas. And then you start to say, okay, what do you want to happen in this season? What are the big sort of headlines? What do we know needs to happen? What do we know sort of we have to hit at any given point? Then we start to say, okay, about what episode? Again, this differs. Sometimes showrunners have a pretty clear idea of that. Sometimes they're really open to changing that. Sometimes you find out you have less episodes than you thought you had, and you have to compress those, into less time, which has happened a few times. And then you from there start, basically just getting more and more micro. So then you figure out, okay, what's happening in each episode. Then again, depending on the room, sometimes as a writer, you know what your episode is ahead of time. And sometimes you have more agency from the very beginning to be like coming in and pitching like ideas for your episode. You get responses from that. Sometimes you're breaking it all together in a very micro way, and then you're going off to write the outline as the writer. It really depends on the show and how the showrunner sort of operates. Sometimes you're, leading the room in a different way if it's your episode. Sometimes, the showrunner is still leading it, and you're breaking it, beat by beat by beat. And then you go sequentially. So you go from, usually the pilot's already written, so you go second episode, third episode, onwards, and then you leave to go write your outline. Then you start getting notes on the outline. Eventually, you go to draft, and that just sort of happens. There's always a funny moment where we're over the halfway mark of my current room, but you have this sort of funny time where everyone is sort of in and out because people are working on. You're about halfway through the season, or a little more, and so you're like, or sorry, yeah, through the season, and then you're saying like. That person is getting notes, so they're out. That person is revising their outline. That person's going to draft. That person, the showrunner is doing 100 things. So it gets a little bit more sort of in and out in the middle. But it really is sort of that macro to micro structure. And really, it's really rigorous. And I think something people don't realize about writers' rooms too is it's not a lot of writing. It's a lot of talking, and it's a lot of problem solving and figuring out sort of all these brains in a room, ideally like incredible brains. In my experience, yeah, I've worked with like only the most brilliant people. And like you're just looking and looking and looking at something in under a microscope, and then you have to pull out and you have to go back in, and you think something's working, but something's gnawing at you, and you are disagreeing, and it's really fun. And then you're like landing on something together, and you're starting a conversation that someone else picks up, or you're helping analyze someone else's pitch. And it really becomes this flow of conversation that you do a ton of that before you ever sit down to write. So it's really different in that way. It's a lot of sort of like that sort of detective editor work that I would say happens. And then when you sit down to write, again, depending on the room, like you usually have a lot of details already. And so the actual like outline to script part is so different, at least for me, than like writing a play or writing a feature, where you're really like coming at it with a much more open space. This is sort of like you obviously have, you know, have to write the dialogue and you have to fill in the blanks, but it's a really different process for, you know, getting a script written.
So when you're writing something that doesn't have all of the structure of a writer's room imparted upon it, when you're working on your own feature or something like that, how do you approach structure? Do you outline or are you a seat of the pantser when left to your own devices?
So it depends on the medium and the project, honestly. I would have said before, a few years ago, I would have said like, no, I never outline. Like I hate outlining. And I sort of famously hated it through school. Like it felt so uncreative to me. But after being in these rooms and having this incredible education through these rooms, I do really see the benefit of outlining for TV specifically. Though I would say when I'm working on my own project, my outlines look really, really different than the outline that I would do for a room. And you know, if I'm starting a pilot or TV project, I'm journaling for a long time before. I'm sort of just like thinking about everything. You're building a whole world. TV is crazy in that way. It's like you're opening so many doors. And then I'm starting to be like, okay, who are these characters? What do I want from them? What are these like, you know, I really start from like character and theme. Those are sort of my like an emotion and like those are my big things. And then I find plot through that. Some people are reverse and it's I love to see how people work differently, but plot to me comes from like character and emotion and the stuff that I want to write usually. So then I start to sort of dream out scenes and then I sort of start to throw them together and then I do the classic note card thing where you're kind of moving them around, and then I either make my girlfriend or whoever, whatever unlucky or lucky person is nearby me to talk it out with me and make me sort of help me figure that out, because I think that's one of the biggest challenges of writing something for TV on your own is that you're not really meant to do this thing on your own. Like I said, it's a really collaborative thing. And then as far as features go, I would say for me, it's a little bit less, it's structured in that I have milestones and I have like my own sense of what I want to hit in a large structure way. But I hadn't written a feature in a while and I was working on this feature in the fall and the winter. I kept getting so frustrated because I kept thinking like, okay, like can't someone help me like answer this question? Like anyone out there to like help me answer this? Because for TV you have that. You have like people to help you. And I kept being like, I have to answer all these
Right.
questions by the end of the movie myself, and nobody can help me answer them. Like I have to do it, which is like such a different experience. And then plays. So yeah, so for film, it's like I know where I'm going. I have a treatment, I would say, where I know like the whole sort of structure and like what's gonna happen in the movie, but I don't really scene by scene outline as much until I sort of hit maybe a problem, and then I start to sort of try to figure out how to fix that. With plays, no outlining. Plays are like, I have an idea, I have characters, I just let them start talking. I write it completely out of order. I handwrite the whole thing, and then I have to figure out the puzzle of what it looks like in its completion. So that's kind of my like from organized to disorganized, because plays have to come out in this like totally different way. They have to be much more unconscious for me.
Wow. I don't want to sound like your therapist here, but talk to me some more about handwriting, because I find that fascinating that you handwrite when it's theater. Can you possibly answer the question why?
Yeah, I love this question. And to be honest, I handwrite film and TV sometimes too. I don't do
Okay.
the whole thing, but if I'm in a scene and I'm stuck and it's like that thing I talked about. It's like that wild witchy side thing. It's like that is like almost never going to come out when I'm typing. And there's a few reasons why. Like I've always been a handwriter, first of all, so it connects me to like something creative. They've also done research about this. There's just like a different connection to sort of your creative brain when you're handwriting. So that's always been the case for me. When I look at a page and I write in these like same types of notebooks, like the sort of wide Moleskine soft ones, and I'll be writing and then I'll think of an idea from a totally different scene or a totally different character, and then I'll write sideways over here, and then I'll be like, oh no, I have to go back to this, and then I'll like circle that, and then I'll like start a totally different thing. I'll circle that over there, then I'll go back into that thing. I don't even know the names and the characters yet. I'm just sort of hearing and listening and figuring it out. If I'm sitting at a computer, it's like I can't do that. It's so linear, it's so like boxed in. And then there's the thing of distraction too, which is like, been obviously a problem more in the last 5, 10 years, but it's so easy to be distracted on a computer in a way where when I'm in my notebook, I turn my phone off, I turn my internet off. I do like an hour or two where I'm just with that, and it gives me that space. And I think it takes away the pressure too of like when something's on a computer screen, it suddenly has this like finality that, I think is really dangerous for early stages of something.
A
But I
weird
find it,
artificial gravitas sort of thing, just
yeah,
because
it's like
it's lit up on a screen.
it's lit up on a screen. You have to save it with a document name. It suddenly is like tangible in this way. Which I find really like antithetical to starting something new or creating something like weird and fresh, because as soon as you kind of try to put a pin in something like that, it like disappears. It doesn't want to be named. It doesn't want to be like quantified or qualified in that way. But it's been really fascinating because probably my favorite part of the process of writing something new, specifically a play, let's say, is that the part where I start to type up what I've handwritten, because it's almost like I'm discovering it for the first time. Because when I'm handwriting and I'm writing first draft, it's almost like a blackout quality. And so then I'm like, oh, interesting. And then I get to use that editor brain and be like, I think that's in the beginning of the play, or I think that's later, or I think what I'm getting at here is this, and it's almost like putting together this like puzzle of the typing up. And then what's really interesting is that when I revise, I sometimes try to cheat because it's already in there. So I sometimes started like, I'll tell myself like, oh, I can sort of type up the revision of this scene, but as soon as it goes beyond like 3 or 4 lines, it's shit. Like it's not good. And then I have to go back and go back to my notebook and like get back in that zone again, which is really fascinating.
Do
But
you
yeah, with my
ever
sorry, go ahead.
print out what's been typed up and do your scribbling on that paper? Or do you always go back
Sometimes
to your
I
notebook?
usually go back to my notebook. Yeah, I usually go
Okay.
back for the sake of just like ease. And then like I think it's like, it is like artists, writers, like you have these rituals, and as you get older too, you're like the rituals help you lock in. And I think that like the handwriting for me is that. And like, there are certain things like with my feature when I would get frustrated, and even though I was typing a lot of that, because I think the visual element of film and TV, it's easier for me to type that. But then I would hit these walls where I'd be like, it needs to be spookier, it needs to be weirder, it needs to be more unconscious. And I would just have to go back to my journal and just go and just like, and half of that stuff didn't end up in the movie because a lot of it is also like, conversations. Because I come from theater, so it's like sometimes I learn about characters more through the way they speak, but I don't need to actually put that in my film and TV because it's too much. So that's like one cheat that I have that I'll go back. But it is really fascinating that even with film and TV, even though the process is much more starting on the computer because of formatting too, it's just like a lot of that stuff then plays, there still are these moments where I have to say like, okay, I'm hitting a wall. It's feeling too like artificial. Like I need to go to my journal and I need to like get weird in my journal and do that. So I think that yeah, the handwriting thing, every time I've tried to cheat, it's just it doesn't work. So I have to do the handwriting.
Well, knowing thyself is a big part of being a successful writer. And I liked what you were saying about ritual, because in general, honestly, for me as a person, I don't consciously think a lot about ritual, but I do have to say both Bailey and I were in the UK late last year for a story summit event where we were spending some time writing and reading aloud in front of a group what we had written that day and those sorts of
Oh,
things.
awesome.
And a lot of people were getting up early in the morning, and I'm not really a morning person, but I was going to go with the flow. And part of the morning was lighting some candles in the room where we were all quietly writing together. Now, you can look at that as sort of its own witchy thing, and it does kind of have that vibe. But also, I've got to say, man, did that work on me, because
Yeah.
even after just 2 days of that, if the candles are lit, my brain went right there. It was highly effective. So, rituals don't have to be magic to work. Just whatever it is. If it's your coffee in a particular mug or whatever it is, it's a fantastic thing.
Exactly. Yeah, you're like training your brain. Like the ritual itself is magic. Like that's how I feel too. It's like that makes the magic. Yeah.
The magic was in us all along.
All along.
Thanks, Brian.
Oh, you're welcome.
The
Why and how is the bear so damn good? I realize that's a really broad question, but damn, that show works, and I almost want to say that it shouldn't, but then it knocks it out of the park.
Totally.
I'm not sure I'm accurate and quite fair in saying this, but it seems like the plot is not terribly interesting, but the story is everything. And maybe that's why I love it so much alone. What was your level of participation in the conceiving and writing on the bear?
Yeah, so I definitely feel really lucky because like I said, I was in sort of the original mini room, which was before it was ordered to series. Chris and Joanna had already been working on it. And the purpose of the mini room was sort of to plot out season one, and sort of present it back to FX and really tiny room, really cool people, really chill hours, really exciting, really different, like I said, for me. Even at that point, I guess that point I'd only worked on Gaslit, but then in between seasons or mini room in season one, I worked on The Dropout. So those were both much more research based and resource based. And the bear was a lot of sort of talking about character, talking about emotion, talking about the restaurant business, and also all of our way in. I've had a lot of shitty jobs. I've not worked in the service industry intentionally, but had a lot of other shitty jobs. But my sort of way in originally to the world that Chris is portraying is through theater, honestly, which for me that comparison was like, we're all in a dark, grimy room till late into the early hours and we're paid nothing and we do it because we love it and it's also kind of abusive to us and we still do it. And I think everybody has their comparison of that, right? Even my dentist was like, he watched The Bear recently and then he was like, my dental office is just like The Bear. It doesn't seem like it. It seems very calm in here for me, but I guess it is for you. But I think anyone who sort of can relate to also just like the dysfunctional family, dysfunctional found family, Chris, this is really his passion project. And then Joanna, the kosher runner, is so brilliant as well. And I think that a lot of those early days were spent just figuring out who these characters are. And partially, Chris has a lot of sort of personal connection to the material. And so that's its own interesting thing, when you have a showrunner who is really attached to characters because they're based on people that he loves. And so it's sort of like balancing that with making these characters their own people as well. The bear has been the room where it's the most sort of coming in and just like telling stories about your life, telling funny stories, telling family stories, telling drug stories, telling like memories from childhood, whatever it is. Because it's a room where we're sort of like you said, the plot is not, the forefront, the story is. And I love that you made that distinction because I think like to me, story is more about these arcs and it's really, really subtle in the bear too. And I think that it really has been an interesting process too, because partially being a half hour, partially the way that it just functions, like we would build things and then have to take things out because it was too full. Really is quite subtle. It's quite nuanced in that way. And then I think, there's so many reasons why it's special. I think that it's, Chris's vision from the beginning is so special. It's so specific. and Joanna's, brilliance too behind that. And I think that it's a lesson that I wish that execs would learn more, and I wish studios would learn more, which is like when something is just unabashedly itself and is fiercely itself and is unlike anything that you've seen and, feels like a risk in that way. When it pays off in such a big way. And it's a lesson I wish that they would continue to learn. And it was very exciting to have the success of the first season. And I think that when I saw the pilot after they'd shot it and then it got ordered to series, I was like, this is really special. Like there's something really, really special here. And you could feel it in the room, but then when you just saw the energy in production and the performances, I was like, oh yeah, this is gonna hit. This is gonna hit. But you never know like how it's gonna hit and in what way. And then I think it was really exciting. That's, it's the only show that like I said, it's the only one that I've worked on a subsequent season of, whereas the other stuff has all been like new or limited series. And so to come back for season two and that season's so special to me. And I think that, given more freedom to sort of slow down and like do what we wanted and like we could have done a season that, had that same velocity and speed, but we wanted to do something different and also like really live in these characters and have more time and space with them, which I thought was a really smart move on the part of the creators and really fun to be a part of. And yeah, I just think it's special in that way. And again, I wish, my favorite shows, all TV takes forever to get made if it gets made at all. And all of my favorite shows, probably all of them, like my favorite shows, took so long to get made and to get into their form. And The Bear started as a feature that Chris had written and
Oh.
a while ago, and ultimately became TV. And I think like it's a fight. It's a fight to get something that feels new and fresh and different. And if you can do it, again, like I said, all my favorite shows. I mean, I May Destroy You, Pen 15, Mad Men. You have these examples of scripts that changed shape or languished in a drawer or, had one person that took a chance on them, and then changed culture forever, and I think like it, I hope we continue to sort of learn that lesson, because I think in this time where there's so much content and so many options, like to have something that rises above that, like The Bear, which was so cool and unexpected, like it is a testament to letting artists be artists and do their thing and make things that feel wholly original and exciting. And I just, yeah, I hope that lesson continues to be learned.
You mentioned your enthusiasm for season two, and yes, I'm not a person who spends a lot of time deciding if X is better than Y. But for people who said, "Oh, I preferred season one of The Bear," I just think, "What are you talking about?" I mean,
I
season one was
agree. Yeah. Of
great,
course.
but you're a fan of the show and you prefer season one. I'm immediately suspicious of you as a person because season
Really
two,
close. Yeah.
wow. So did you write, and you probably know which episode I'm going to ask about. Did you write episode six, Fishes?
No. So Chris wrote that.
Okay, okay.
But we, like with the writer's room, you help figure out the whole thing with everybody. But Chris, I think Chris and Joe maybe co-wrote that one. And that was something that we had talked about originally in the mini room, because we thought we were going to get 10 episodes in the mini room for the first season. And then FX gave us 8, which is a thing that happens all the time. And so Chris was sort of like, we can't do any of these like special episodes that we wanted to do. So what was fun in season two is we got more space to do that. We got, the Sydney episode, the Richie one, which is my personal favorite. Which my
The
friend Alex wrote is
Richie
so good.
episode. Wow.
It's so,
Wow.
and I love
I
Evan
rewatched it
so much.
yesterday. I didn't
So
intend to,
good.
but I accidentally saw 30
And
seconds of it, and then I
you
had to
had
watch
to,
the
yeah.
whole thing. It's insane. So is it Chris who brings all the Chicago-ness to the show? How is it so appropriately Chicago, and how did all the Midwesternisms get in there and be as correct as they are? I'm a Midwesterner,
Yes.
and I often hear things said like in that episode six when somebody says "pop machine," not "soda
Yes,
machine."
pop.
I mean,
Yep,
I
yep.
long ago decided that I sound like a yokel when I say pop machine, so I stopped doing that, I think, in high school. But when I heard it, I'm like, ah, somebody knows what they're talking about. Did that come from Chris?
Yeah, he's from Chicago. A lot of this, you know, comes from his like passion project. He's also part of the ethos of the show that is great. And part of what makes it great is like this commitment to, to authenticity in that way. And to that end, like his sister is an amazing chef and a consultant on the show. And we talked to so many chefs through the process of the show and so many, you know, restaurant people, and it's really important, you know, for us to get it right, which I think is great. My parents are from Detroit, so I also grew up hearing pop all the time. And I lived in Chicago, you know, for a few years for grad school. That was a really exciting thing to bring to the show, and sort of like in thinking about like, I absolutely love Chicago. And so, you know, it has such a special place in my heart. And each of the writers, you know, we sort of all had some attachment to the area, but Chris, it really comes from his original connection to the place.
Are we still saying teleplay in the TV industry? What are they, screenplays? Are they teleplays? Are they scripts? What do you guys say when you're in the room?
I hear scripts most.
Okay, because I feel like teleplay is a little
I haven't heard it. This point. Grad school. Yeah, I feel like it's the last time I heard it.
How much of what we see on the screen was in the script going in? Things like close-ups on the kitchen timer and things. did that come from the writers, or was that on production side to decide to give those things to editorial? Where do the specifics like that originate?
So for TV in general, and then particularly for something like The Bear, this is very like writer controlled, and not necessarily from the room, but Chris also especially comes from directing and producing, and he really is in charge on set in a way that showrunners always are, but like, because he's also a director, like when he writes his own scripts, it's for him, the way that, you know, you'd have like a Tarantino script or like something where it's like, you know, this is what I know that I'm going to do that's happening, and I have the control here. So I would say like rigorous, like for sure. But also I think something cool about The Bear that isn't always the case, just because different shows don't require this, is there is a lot of room for sort of the actors to improv and sort of add in their own flavor to things. And that's something that Chris really loves also. So it really depends on the episode. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that I'm thrilled to hear that about some room for actors, because when you've got an episode where you get Bob Odenkirk, John Mulaney, Sarah Paulson, Jamie Lee Curtis, it seems like there must be room for them to do their thing.
Totally.
Totally. And that's a style otherwise. Of The Bear.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a style of The Bear too, that you'll see, you know, in every episode, which is, you know, you have these incredible actors and they're living in these characters, and, you know, they're given a lot of room to sort of like, you know, put their own flavor on something. But it really depends on the episode, sort of how much of that there is. But I would say still like Chris and Joe's, and, you know, Chris's vision for the show is still, you know, very rigorous and very, you know, even your example of sort of like zooming in on the clock, like that's the kind of stuff that is in scripts. Like it is very sort of controlled in that way because of the pacing and the way, and Chris is writing them to shoot them in the way that, you know, he, like I said, like he's a director. So it's a specific style.
Right. It's a little bit of an unfair question, because we have sort of, we have an auteur situation here with The Bear.
Exactly.
So the flow has got to be a little different.
Yeah. But then it's always,
stuff doesn't,
you know,
really ever get handed over on that show to anybody. It's with Chris all the way.
Totally. And, you know, most, you know, these sort of streaming shows and the stuff that I've worked on is like that as well, in the sense of like, you know, as the, one of the big differences between, you know, film and TV, unless you're a director directing your own movie, is you aren't ever handing it over. You know, as the showrunner, you are like, you're in the editing bay, you're on set every day, you're, you know, creating your vision for the show and making sure that that's happening, you know, at every step of the process, which is part of why I think, you know, TV has gotten so good.
the bear is certainly an indicator of a golden age going on. I'm hoping not the end of a golden age, because because the forces of the streaming industry. Well, let's not go. We don't have to go down that road, but there's reason for concern.
Definitely.
There's a question at Story Summit I see quite often in writers groups, and there's a lot of emerging writers there that who want to work in TV and writer's room. So when if you know the answer to this, when a showrunner is building a room and they're looking to hire writers and things, I know back in maybe when they used to, I think Warner Brothers had a writer's program, mm-hmm. and Disney did as well. When you would apply to those programs, they always wanted you to write an episode of a pre-existing show. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a spec of a pre-existing show. So when these rooms are being staffed now, are writers sort of, are they taking original pilots and submitting those, something that would be original to, or in that vein of, let's say, The Bear or The Dropout, or sort of how is that sort of, if you have any insight on that?
I do. And also you're going to get different answers based on different people's experience and also sort of what shows they've worked on. I'm pretty vehement about you don't need a spec. The only thing you would need a spec for is these programs that you're talking about.
Mm.
In my experience, there's basically in the last 10 years been a major shift towards original pilots and original voices. And basically what they're looking for is a perspective and that you have something to say and that you can write it and achieve it and pull it off. Like I said, my play has been also my main sample. Like that has been, you know, like I said, I have a pilot that people obviously also, you know, like, and they see that I can write in the form. Now I've obviously worked on multiple shows, so I have that, you know, going for me as well. But they really are looking for something that stands out and shows your voice. And so that's why I think why the movement away from specs has happened, because you know, it makes sense in some ways to show like, oh, okay, I can write in the style of, you know, whatever this show is. Because there is some degree of that in a room where you do have to think about, okay, what, you know, what is the showrunner trying to achieve here? How can I write into that? But the newer model, I think, because there's also so many new shows, is like, in my experience too, it's like the showrunner has a vision, but like you're in there helping figure out what the show is. And so they're looking for people who, you know, have unique perspectives and have something to say and can show that from a writing perspective. And I think that's why, like, particularly my play, you know, has been so effective for me. In every interview I've been in with the showrunner, for every job I've gotten, they're, you know, they want to talk about this play. They're like, you know, these characters, this relationship, this dialogue. And so I always encourage, you know, people starting out or people who want to go into TV, like, also that you don't need like five pilots. Like you should, your time is better spent like on one or two that you've worked really, really hard on and like shared with collaborators and gotten feedback on and have honed your voice and then aren't pandering to a certain thing. Like, again, my experience, you're going to get different advice from different people. I think people would always rather read that than like something that's trying to be like The Bear. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, what is your original thing to say? And even if that ends up being a sample that you don't ever develop, like, you know, that's what's going to show people like you are an asset in this room. You will have a perspective that I need, because every room that I've been in also, the showrunner is trying to create obviously like a cohesion, but you also have people who are coming for different reasons and for different things. And it's not always like, you know, I'm the one vouching for this character necessarily. It's not necessarily identity based, but it is about like, okay, are you offering, like I said, part of my niche is like complicated relationships and complicated like emotional and relationship dynamics. And like, that's what my writing also shows. And so I think like, I don't have to be, you know, an expert at everything we're talking about in the show, because people come at it with their different things. So that's why I think at this stage, especially, you know, again, I think it would probably be different if you were like trying to get into procedurals or if you were trying to get into network. Like, I think there still are like gradations of sort of what people are looking for. But in my experience, having that original thing that really shows your voice and your perspective is what's going to raise you to sort of the top of the pile.
I love that, because you're not just, Sure, if I watch enough episodes of a certain show, I can imitate the voice, but I may not have something to say as opposed to bringing my own experiences with it, with my own personal spec, or like you had with your play. So I love hearing that.
And I love it too, because I was about to ask you to please impart some advice to for writers who are early in their careers, and you just went ahead and did it. So that's absolutely perfect.
Yes.
Going back to the realities of being a writer and tackling all the challenges that are involved there, what do you feel like people who aren't writers most misunderstand about the writing process and about what it is to be a writer and live the life of a writer? What do people not get?
I think it's a really good question.
If you were going to try to educate somebody who's not a writer and they say, well, what exactly do you do?
I mean, I think that I have sort of a larger answer and a smaller answer. And I think that the larger answer is I think people are consuming art all the time in their daily lives, constantly. You walk into a coffee shop, you hear a song playing, you pass a painting on someone's wall, you pick up a book at a bookstore, you look online at something someone made, you're watching Netflix every night, you're, engaging with art. And I think that in theory, people know that, there are people behind that. But I think that people really take art for granted and art people take artists for granted. And I think we like really saw that during COVID, where that was sort of all that people could do, or they were really missing, certain types of art. And I think that there's this expectation that art is going to be there and art will keep getting made. And yes, it's true that artists will always be around. And I think that there's this bizarre thing that happens where, yeah, artists are taken for granted and not valued, even though art is everywhere and art is constantly in engagement. So I think like it's important to sort of keep understanding that for every sort of piece of art that people engage with every single day, like there are people behind that. And I think what's interesting about TV is it's one of the only ways that artists can make a good living, like actually, like as artists. In theater, you can't make a living as a playwright. You have to be a professor or you have to go to TV, unless you're like Lin-Manuel Miranda, but then that's still, you're not earning your whole, income from specifically theater. So I think that, or my friends who are musicians, it's completely, that industry is completely, devaluing them. And so I think that that is a big part of just like what I want people to remember is that like valuing artists is so important. And that I think it's important as artists to remember that we deserve to be valued, because I think it feels really easy to kind of drink that Kool-Aid and be like, what I do is not important or frivolous, or I live under capitalism, and unless I'm making X amount of money doing the thing that I want to be doing, it's not important. And then I think, the money of it all is also just something that people don't understand, which is like, the level of control that studios and execs have in trying to create art, and not to be sort of dark about it, but I do think a lot of the good stuff that gets made, like I said earlier, is because a fight has been put up to make it, and I think like learning to make that fight. And so I think, as people who aren't writers or aren't artists, continuing to advocate for artists and art's importance in this world, because, is it the Winston Churchill quote about without the artist, there's nothing to fight for, and I think it's so important always to live in a society that artists like are messengers and we're reflectors and we're reflecting back into in society and we're sort of helping create and shape culture. And I think that's what's really appealing to me about working for plays and theater. I get this amazing experience where one person comes up to me after a play and says, "Oh my God, like I never thought about this thing this way. Thank you." Or, "I never thought I'd see that relationship conveyed in that way. Thank you." Or I get an email from a random college student, who did a scene from a play saying as much. And those are so amazing. And then with film and TV, you get this opportunity to do that on a larger scale and be a part of a shifting cultural conversation. And I just don't take those things lightly, but I do feel like they get taken for granted. And so I just think the value that we put on art and artists is this magical thing that we need to keep emphasizing. And I think that yeah, I think as things start to get darker or more complicated, or like, not going to go into AI, but that's like another sort of like dark version of this, right? That like, as human beings, we need art, and we need art made by other humans, and it makes life worth living. And I don't take that lightly. And I just sort of feel like people forget because we're so immersed in art all the time, but all of it is its own specific part of what makes this world beautiful. So maybe just that. I feel like I went on a little
No,
strange
that
rant there,
was,
but
well, whatever happened there, it was beautiful and well put, and I agree with you passionately, and I've never heard it put quite like that. So thank you. And thank you for your time today.
yeah,
This
this
has
was
been
awesome.
fascinating, and I kind of hate to stop because I could probably ask you another 3 hours of questions just about season
Awesome.
two, episode six of The
Yes.
Bear, but we'll be fair and
Yeah.
we'll let you go back to real life now. Thank you. Your time and insight have been incredibly appreciated. I hope you've had a decent time with us here
This
today.
was awesome. Yeah.
And look forward to having you back. Well, after your feature gets made, let's do that.
Yeah, we'll bring her back. Yeah.
Yes.
All
Yes.
right.
I want to direct it, so that's the plan. Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Exciting.
And
Yeah.
you did say it was horror, right?
Yeah, it's my feminist horror movie.
Oh, I can't
Woo.
wait. My
I'm
favorite
excited.
genre, so.
Yeah, me too.
Exciting.
Me
Well,
too.
we'll check in with you on that, and Bailey
Awesome.
will find a way to get you back here.
Perfect.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much,
Thank
Sophia.
you,
Thank
guys.
you.
Wow, that was fantastic. Big thanks to Sophia for her time today, and thank you, Bailey, for finding us another amazing guest. I feel a little like I say the same thing every time because you keep finding us great guests, but a sincere thank you to you because the show wouldn't be the show without the guests.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for saying that. She was so inspiring and she had so much valuable insight. And I mean, if you're not really motivated after that,
Yeah.
might need more coffee or something, or
While I was really enjoying talking to her, I was also motivated to go get writing and go get things done because, man, the positions I find myself in terms of busyness that I might complain about, at least inside my own head, she's solidly 80 times busier than I've ever been. And she's not complaining about a thing. She's just getting the work done. So I'm impressed and inspired.
yes, me too. Yeah, I'll have to reach back out to her and we can get her back on the show after her next big project. I'm sure she'll have even more adventures to share with us.
That'd be great. And of course, selfishly, as well, I think I revealed myself during the interview as a bit of the Bear fanboy. And that'd be great because then I'd have a chance to work in a few more the Bear questions for her, but not so many that it scares her away or creates a 3 hour episode. Although I suspect we do have listeners out there who wouldn't mind at all a 3 hour conversation with her solely about The Bear.
Definitely. And what I found really interesting about her, and it just goes to show people can break into Hollywood, into a room, a hundred different ways. There's not one way. She broke in with a play.
Yeah.
And that's her main writing sample for whether that's to get her hired on The Bear or wherever else. So I found that to be really inspiring.
The lesson there is write the thing that only you can write. And make sure it means something to you. It doesn't have to mean something to everybody. If it means enough to you, it's going to mean enough to enough other people to, with a little bit of luck, because there's always a little bit of luck involved, it'll make things happen.
Definitely, definitely. Well, let's wrap this up so we can go right then.
Okay, I'll take you up on that. So, once again, thanks to Sophia Levetsky-Weitz for being so generous with her time, insights, and advice today. And of course, thanks also to Story Summit for making this podcast possible. To meet other writers, turbocharge your craft, and learn about the industries writers care about, it really doesn't get any better than the generous people at Story Summit. Both Bailey and I have been involved with Story Summit since the beginning, so we know of what we speak. Please check them out now at storysummit.us. Thanks for listening, everyone, and until next time, keep writing and never give up on finding your audience, producer, or publisher. You'll hear a lot of no's, but don't give up because all it takes is that one yes. I've been your host, Brian Landwehr. This episode produced by myself and Bailey Patterson with the support of David Paul Kirkpatrick of Story Summit.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Original music by Kenton Edwards.